From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part one in a series of conversations about literary translation. What are the status and importance of translation for both academic and popular audiences? Do Americans enjoy full citizenship in the world's literary community? The panelists in the following portion of the discussion are Reiner Schulte, Richard Bjornson, Donald Frame, and Joan Stewart. Reiner Schulte directs the Translation Center at the University of Texas at Dallas. Richard Bjornson teaches comparative literature at Ohio State University and has served as president of the American Association of Literary Translators. Donald Frame of Columbia University has translated the works of Rabelais, Voltaire, and Montaigne. Joan Stewart teaches French at North Carolina State University. Professors Bjornson, Frame, and Stewart recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center.
Translation has really not been paid attention to that much over the last 5 or 10 years. The big publishers are very hesitant to publish new books from abroad because they don't know how it is going to go commercially speaking. The area where really the translation has gotten a tremendous uplift in the last few years is in the areas of small publishers and university publishers. I think most university publishers have recognized not only the scholarly area, but also in the original creative area, that they have to go ahead and publish works from other countries to promote the dissemination of other cultures into this. On the whole, I would say that the translation from other countries is pretty much at an ad hoc, on an ad hoc basis. Certain books get published, others that should get published do not get published. Interesting case is obviously the Garcia Marquez translation by Gregory Rabassa, and I think there the translator really helped him to get the kind of recognition, the kind of fame, the kind of exposure. Not necessarily alone because of the power of the original work, but because of the excellent translation that such a book has.
In general popular terms, Reiner, would you say that Americans are aware of literary translation? Do they take advantage of what's available? Are they citizens of the world's literary community?
I would say in general, no. I think there's a certain insularity. René Dubos said, we were supposed to think globally and act locally. I think we might act locally, but I think we're not thinking globally, at least not in the area of literature yet. And I would think that in the next few years, that awareness has to be raised.
I think there's one thing that one has to remember within this situation, though, is that English has become an almost universal language. Mm-hmm. So that for a writer to become well known throughout the world, it's almost necessary for him to become translated into English. The case of García Márquez that Reiner mentioned just a moment ago is an extraordinarily good one, because García Márquez's novel was extraordinarily popular in Latin America. It was the single most popular book ever to have been published in South America. At the time that it was published, however, there probably were not more than two or three Latin American writers, Borges, Asturias, who might have been known to the English-speaking world. With Gregory Rabassa's extraordinarily fine translation, this book took off, and it was translated, it's been translated now into over 50 languages. And I think that the translation that Gregory Rabassa did played a very important role in making him sufficiently visible so that he would be considered as a candidate for the Nobel Prize. You must add to this, too, that many governments have a policy of supporting the translation of works from their country. The German government just recently, for example, has paid to have 100 translations of classic German works published in a series in New York. Various other governments, particularly Eastern Bloc countries, publish an enormous number of things in English, which are subsequently distributed throughout the world. So that there is a desire on the part of many governments to make the literature of their countries more well known, and in particular in English.
Dick, all of this brings up a number of questions. Let me ask a very broad one. Are translators artists or artisans? That is to say, are they creators or are they mechanics? Do they carry the work to the public, or do they, in effect, present new works to the public?
This is an extraordinarily complex question in which you would probably find that every translator you spoke to would give you a somewhat different answer. Obviously, the appeal of translation for many people is that it is a creative act. Many people who have been attracted to translation were themselves creative writers. They did an apprenticeship in the area of translation. When one becomes deeply engrossed in translation, translating a word from another linguistic and cultural context into our own, you see that every word, every sentence, every paragraph presents a series of problems that have to be solved. This problem-solving activity is like playing, in a way, playing in the most serious sense of the word, and that playing is fun. And so people can get absorbed in translation. I have occasionally started out working at 7 o'clock in the morning and discovered all of a sudden that it was 11 o'clock at night, and I didn't know what had happened in the meantime. Mm-hmm. There is something else that one might mention. I think it was I.A. Richards who once said the translator in the act of translation is performing one of the most complex mental feats imaginable, far more complex than piloting a jet plane or driving down a Los Angeles freeway, simply because that translator is having to juggle so many alternatives at any given moment of the task that he or she is trying to accomplish.
Let me put a question to Don Frame. You've done a lot of translation. You've translated Montaigne. You are working on Rabelais. How serious is this responsibility? How do you think of yourself as a translator, given the publics that you address? And what are the most serious problems that you worry about when you translate from French into English?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems we get into is priorities. We were talking about that the other day, and establishing your clear sense of what you think the author's priorities would be, because with any worthwhile author, of course, you're having to make choices among the things you can do that he is doing, and letting go of the things you know you can't. For me, the big problem there is getting anything like the constant word plays, the technical term is annominatio, pairing or juxtaposition of two words of similar sound and very different meaning. And in some cases, I think you can come up with something, and in some cases, I know I can't, and I don't think, and I know nobody has who's tried it.
Let me just give you an example which might illustrate one of the sorts of problems that Don faces. In a small novel that was published in 1554, Lazarillo de Tormes, there is a phrase in the very first few pages of the first chapter where it is said that the father of Lazarillo padeció por justicia. Now, that is a phrase that comes from the biblical passage, he suffered for righteousness' sake, but justicia also refers explicitly to the police. There is no way that you can find one single term for justicia which will translate into English the full complexity of that phrase in the original.
And you have to resort to footnotes and things like that, which get in the way between the work and the reader?
I don't really think so, that in those cases one should resort to the footnotes, because in translation, that have too many footnotes, there are all kinds of theories on it, but I think the footnotes in a translation, if they're too many, it delays the reader's reaction to the text. And I think that goes back to what Dan was saying. There, the translator has to see that something that cannot be recreated through the word in itself, it has to be recreated through the context. In other words, there might be another passage or another moment where that idea could be recreated, although it is not implicitly said in one word in the text. And that is the real refined art of the translator. Because otherwise, a text in a translation has to live in itself. And it lives in itself because it is based on the coherent interpretation of the translator. And when the translator has that coherent perspective in mind, then he or she will be able to recreate those nuances, even though a particular word might not give him or her that possibility. And there are cases, obviously, where the footnote is the only way out. But on the whole, I would say that this kind of atmosphere, this kind of nuance of meaning, can be worked into the text in one form or another.
Some people also refer to compensation, the fact that if you cannot get the full meaning into in one instance, you may, in the adjacent instance, find something that in English that has more meanings and is able to carry across, as in the case of Lazarillo, a biblical echo that was not there in the original. So that if you take the two cases together, you have the biblical echo, you have the duality of word meaning in another word you've created in English, but not in precisely that one. And some translators would consider that this process of translation as a way of creating a totality in the translation that would be similar to the totality of the original work. Because one has to ask oneself, what is one attempting to do with translation? What is one's goal? And the goal, if it is defined differently, will produce two quite different translations. If your goal is to create the totality of a literary work which will have the same emotional impact upon the reader in English as it would have had on the reader in the original language, your translation might be somewhat different than if your goal was to be absolutely faithful to the intention of the original author.
I'd just like to bring in an illustration, not from anything of my own, but of the points that Reiner and Dick were just making. An instance in some of Morris Bishop's fine translations of Molière's comedies. One, I at the moment don't have the play in mind, but it doesn't matter, where there's something that I would call almost a kind of baby talk from wife to somewhat henpecked husband, and where at a given point in the text, as far as I can see, there's no way of putting that into English. But perhaps a few lines later, three sentences later, there's a chance to, and he does, where precisely it isn't in the French, but he brings it in the English. And I say, bravo, I think that's very good. This is, I think, exactly the kind of compensation that Dick was speaking of.
Let us say that I have a word which can be translated very easily into English. Maison, house, very simple. But in an African context, when somebody says maison, that does not refer to what you or I would think of as a house in English. It would be much more like a hut, a shack. Do I translate that word as hut or shack, or do I translate it as house? My own strong inclination is to translate that word as house, leaving the same ambiguity of possible interpretation in English as existed in the French, assuming that a person reading this novel would be able to put himself or herself into that context and say, when house is spoken in a French-speaking African context, one is referring to a hut or a shack. There are other people who would say that, no, in order to make this perfectly clear to an American audience, one has to say hut or shack to draw up the picture within the mind of the reader that this is not a house in the American sense of the word.
Can you give me an example where you would opt to follow what you have called the author's intention then? Because I certainly would choose house in that situation too, and it seems to me that most people would, although I'm perhaps wrong. What would be an example when you wouldn't go with word that would make the impact that you're looking for?
I think there's something we need to clarify here before we go on. We're talking about the intention of the author, and the intention of the author is quite often different from what happens in the work. So we need to make another distinction. I think what we're talking about, to reconstruct the work as it is and not worry too much at this point what the author might have wanted to do or might have wanted to say, because those are two different things. We have had authors who have said elaborately in the contemporary scene, this is what I wanted to do in the work, but when you look at it, this wasn't happening in the work. So I think we must make a distinction here between the intention of the author and what we're now doing is the reconstruction of the work from the translator as interpreter. And I think I would like to introduce that at this point, because otherwise one says all you have to do is go to the author and say, please tell me what your intention was in the work, and then I will go and translate it. And we know that that's not the case.
Well, then you're both saying that what you do is attempt to reproduce the work.
Yes.
And that you essentially disregard the question of what you think the author's intention was.
Reiner, aren't you saying that the translators have to become mind readers, in a sense?
No, I don't think the translators have to become mind readers. I think the translators have the same responsibility that a critic has. The critic is supposed to illuminate for us as reader the text that we are reading.
But now you've shifted the burden of translation from the individual who carries the water to the individual who makes the water, colors
no.
the water, changes the water.
I don't think so at all. I think there is no translator that can function without being first an interpreter and critic of the work. I think those two cannot go.
Otherwise, what? We leave it to computers.
Well, we leave it to computers, and we know that that doesn't go. And we also know, especially from my point of view, those people who go about translating without taking this into consideration as an interpreter, the translator's interpreter, produce continuously unacceptable translations because they miss the content and the context of a particular text. And the strange thing is that frequently those translations come from people who know the original language extremely well. That is a phenomenon that I have not been able to explain why that is. People who know in the original language extremely well frequently fail in transposing and transplanting the situations and the context of the text that they're translating.
Perhaps because they're so much more aware of the full complexity of the original text.
Either that...
And they would like very much to be able to convey this or translate this from one context to another, and they find themselves in the position of being impossible to do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one reason, because they get too hung up on all the nuances that mm-hmm. should be carried from one culture into mm-hmm. another, from one language into another. And at the same time, I think frequently what happens there is because of such an overemphasis of the linguistic language understanding and dealing with the text, they overlook that there are so many other aspects for the translator to be considered that are way beyond the linguistic level.
Could they, in some cases, be very resourceful in the language they're translating from, but not very resourceful in English?
That's a very important
aspect. It
seems
to me that resourcefulness in English is an absolute essential for any translation of a worthwhile work.
Extremely
important.
Far more
than the good knowledge of the other language.
If the translator in the language he or she is translating into is, does not have the full capacity to recreate what is there in the original, then we have problems. Yeah. And the emphasis should always be on that final draft in English or whatever language we're translating into.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first segment in a series of discussions about literary translation and its status and importance for scholarly and popular audiences. The participants in the following portion of the conversation are Inez Hedges, Donald Frame, Richard Bjornson, Joan Stewart, and Reiner Schulte. Inez Hedges teaches Romance languages and comparative literature at Duke University. Reiner Schulte directs the Translation Center at the University of Texas at Dallas. Donald Frame of Columbia University, Richard Bjornson of Ohio State University, and Joan Stewart of North Carolina State University recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center.
But surely, whatever kind of translation you decide to produce is going to depend very much on what this translation will be used for. And the example that Don just gave from Molière, you would be trying to produce a comic effect, and you would definitely want your audience to laugh. So that might establish a whole different set of priorities than if you were, for instance, translating the Bible, where you have to get the referential message across. And Eugene Nida, for instance, mentions in his works that when you translate the heart to some cultures, you have to use, in Greek, you have to say liver a lot of the time. In Kabalaka, which is in a language of French Equatorial Africa, you have to say abdomen and so on. So there you're privileging the message, whereas with Molière you're privileging some sort of comic sense.
But isn't that part of the message?
It's part of the message, but it's a different priority, it seems to me. You'd be justified in making other choices than if you were trying to convey just simply the word of God, as you would in Bible translating, where you'd have some authority. The text would have a different kind of authority than in a comedy. I was just, if I can give another example, I was wondering this morning how to translate a joke from Freud's work jokes and their relation to the unconscious. And there's a quotation that he gives from Heine, which is, "Bis mir alle Knöpfe rissen an der Hose der Geduld," which literally would be, "until all the buttons on the pants of my patience popped open." Well, I don't think that's very funny if you translate it that way. And you have the problem that in German you talk about patience tearing, whereas in English you talk about patience wearing out. And so in English I would say that I had worn out the seat of my patience, or the seat of the pants of my patience. So that there, in order to be funny, you're making a whole different set of choices than you would make, I think, in another kind of situation.
Isn't the problem that pants have zippers in America and not buttons, or have I completely misunderstood it?
There was a time, of course. I would like to chime in just to agree strongly with Inez's point, last point, that it seems to me there is a category that is in some way special, and one I haven't ventured into, where fidelity to meaning as such seems to be overruling of almost any other value.
But there is also the common expression, traduttori traditori, a translator necessarily betrays the original text. And I think that this is obviously true of biblical texts as well. For a long period of time, Islam refused to allow the translation of the Quran because they felt that the word of God could only be expressed in Arabic. Another example, which Nida gives in his book, which illustrates this point very clearly, is that in one central African language, the word for God, the only acceptable word for God, is feminine. That's all very well until you try to explain the virgin birth. And it, they had an extraordinary difficulty trying to translate that into that particular language, and perhaps did not fully succeed in doing it. So that there is a kind of impossibility in the task which Inez is describing here of fully translating anything. And I think that she's perfectly right to point out that when you make a prior choice, what are you going to emphasize? You may emphasize sound patterns, you may emphasize doctrinal intent, you may emphasize the desire to break certain linguistic conventions. There are a great number of choices that you make, and you make these choices repeatedly throughout the text as you're translating.
Inez, let me come back to a point that you made. What do you mean by the authority of the translation? That seems like a slippery
term. No, I was talking about the certain texts have been invested in our culture with a kind of authority that...
The Bible, for instance.
The Bible, that one tends to want to respect, although some people are more interested in the literary qualities of the Bible's language, and I would assume that they would make a different kind of translation because they would be concerned with metaphor and alliteration. But I think that if we're approaching a literary text, we have a much freer hand in deciding just what sorts of things we're going to privilege. And I myself find that as a translator, my choice of priorities depends to a great extent on the kind of audience I'm trying to reach, the kind of use that this translation will be put to, and a host of considerations like those. So that if I'm translating something which has been recently rediscovered and is historically significant, such as a Dada novel that was recently rediscovered by Melchior Fischer, there I would want to provide a document for other researchers, and I wouldn't take very many liberties with finding cultural equivalents for the modern American reader. On the other hand, if I were translating a modern concrete poet, I wouldn't consider it a document, but rather I would be trying to give the American reader the same experience in reading the concrete poem that the German reader would have. And I would be forced to make rather radical transformations of that text.
I'd like to ask another question related to the goals of the translator. Reiner, you said something yesterday which interested me very much. You mentioned that one of your goals was improvement of the original text when you were translating. And I wondered if you and the others could comment on the extent to which improving a text is part of your agenda.
I have to be very careful because I don't mean to say that I'm going to improve the original text. I was talking about specific instances where, poetically speaking, I think it's mostly true in poetry, where, poetically speaking, the poet has produced a weak line in the original. And now you might ask me, what is a weak line in the original? And I say, well, we will discuss that some other time. Let's just assume we know what that weak line is. And it happens that in the translation, you find the expression that really hits that situation, and it is makes it much stronger than what it was in the original. In moments like this, I personally, as a translator, believe, use the resources of the new language.
But aren't you really being unfair to the poet?
No, I don't think I'm unfair, because all the moments that I'm losing his or her intensity, I'm making up a few small places.
But that's your intensity as opposed to his or her intensity.
No, I think it's an intensity that comes within the text, within the context of that poem. And that goes back to what we said before.
But the judgment remains yours, nevertheless.
But it's a question of whether you're treating this as a totality or as a single word or line. I think that what Reiner is attempting to do is to treat the poem as a totality rather than as a single word or line, realizing that he is going to have to lose significance over and over and over again, and here he has an opportunity to gain significance so that he will come a little bit closer in the totality of the poem that he as a translator writes to the intensity of the original poem.
I wonder if the problem isn't even greater in prose translations, though. Everyone who has done any prose translations has had the experience of coming across passages, sentences, whole pages, which on close reading appear not very coherent, poorly written, syntax is shaky. This is perhaps more true of non-literary translation than of literary translation. But what do you do in those circumstances? Do you produce a sentence which also has poor syntax, which is also slightly incoherent, or do you correct it?
My own feeling in, I think, what is roughly that regard is that you have to stay close to the original, but still try to be sure you're conveying something meaningful to the reader. Assuming that is that you're getting something meaningful from the original.
That I think the question that really has to be asked here, Joan, is when you encounter a passage which appears to be badly written, confused syntax, absurdities, you have to ask yourself, is that there for some reason? Have I missed something? And that brings us back to the real question that any translator has to be an interpreter before he or she is a translator. And the question that one has to ask is there something there that I have missed? If so, perhaps I should go back and look at it again and see if there is any way that fits into the totality. That doesn't mean that there can't be passages which are poorly written, and I'm certain that they are. My impulse would be the same as Don's, to say this is part of the text. And if it is confusing to a German or French or Chinese reader, then perhaps it ought to be confusing to the English-speaking reader as well.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the first segment in a series of conversations about literary translation. The panelists were Richard Bjornson of Ohio State University, Inez Hedges of Duke University, Donald Frame of Columbia University, Joan Stewart of North Carolina State University, and Reiner Schulte of the University of Texas. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for part one in a series of discussions about the art of literary translation. What are the status and importance of literary translation for both popular and scholarly audiences? By way of translation, do Americans enjoy full citizenship in the world's literary community? A panel of scholars from Columbia University, North Carolina State University, the University of Texas, Ohio State, and Duke University has some answers and insights. That's The Art of Literary Translation, Part 1, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.